accession number 32297, reel 5.
John Dixon, reel 5. John, I think there was a couple of things you wanted to discuss from the previous tape.
Just a couple of things, yeah. I mentioned that when we first started flying in Tiger Moths, and you asked me what colour were they painted, and I, like an idiot, said yellow. Well, the answer is they were yellow, but only the undersides. The bottom of the fuselage and the undersides of the two wings were yellow. Other than that, they were the normal green and brown camouflage. And that only just came back to me. The other thing was, at Elmden, when we got there, and I told you we lived opposite a place called the Malt Shovel, which was a bit bigger than a pub. It was more like a roadhouse. And the place where we were in Nissen Huts was at the back of the Stonebridge Hotel, which was between Elmden and Coventry, I think, along that road. I have been back there once or twice just to try and locate where we were, but that's all gone. The other thing is that at Elmden, the course was, I believe, officially an 8-week course. Or 2 months, as we called it. And during the first month, we lived out at Stonebridge in these Nissen huts. The second month, when we became the senior course on the air station, we came back to the air station, and I think we were living in Nissen huts. So there we are.
We got to the stage where you'd soloed.
Yes.
Now, are there other things that they introduce you to once you've soloed? I'm thinking of, you know, potentially the prospect of forced landings, you know, what to do in case of fire, that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, very, very, very strong. I mean, once you've gone solo, you think you're the bee's knees, but you've only just started. One thing, of course, we'd already learned how to recover from spins. We went on to supposedly do a lot of aerobatics, and as I've said before, my instructor was never too keen on them. But we did our fair share. We did what we had to. Another thing that we had to do, which was quite frightening, was restarting an engine in flight. And this basically meant you climbed up to about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and then you switched everything off. You turned the petrol off, you turned the ignition off, so the propeller just stopped dead in front of you. And to recover, you shove the nose forward and you dive as near vertically as you can, and then you switch on the fuel and the ignition. And then the airstream will eventually spin the propeller and it will fire up. At least, that's what you hope. And then, having done that, you then recover and carry on as normal. One chap I knew who was so anxious, having seen the propeller start spinning, he thought, well, that's it, I've recovered. And he pulled out, having lost probably, I don't know, 2,000 feet. And the engine stopped again because he'd pulled out too soon, which was an enormous problem because he had to dive, or the instructor took over, and he had to dive like mad to get it going again within the height that was left to them. And I think they achieved it with about 300 or 400 feet to spare. This happened a course or two in front of mine, and it was told to us as a lesson. Never think that the thing is really firing up again until you're absolutely sure. So that was one. And the other thing is what to do in the event of a fire. Well, I suppose there were two options. If you were really on fire and you'd got sufficient height, you probably just jumped out. I think that would be the answer. Or if you were too low to jump out, what you then did was you side-slipped the aeroplane. In other words, you put on top rudder to keep the nose up and full left aileron so that you're slipping down. And the sliding motion through the air, apart from being a normal drill because it helps you shed height if you're too high when you're landing, as you're doing this, the airflow, of course, is blowing away, and that will blow the flames away, presumably from the engine, and give you a chance to get down low enough to make some sort of landing in a field or whatever. Obviously it never ever happened, but this was the drill that we had to learn.
Were you given at this stage any drill on how to operate your parachute?
Oh yes, we were told that long before we actually started flying. When we first joined the course, you were each issued with your own parachute. It was fitted, the instructors fitted it to you, because it had to be really tight. You can understand what it might be a bit uncomfortable if you had it too loose and it suddenly jerked open if you had to jump out. No, we were told exactly how to operate the parachute, but we were, again, an interesting thing, because we were never allowed to make a jump all the time we were in the service, because presumably aircrew were too valuable to go leaping about for fun. But I did do a parachute jump, but much later in life.
How was the parachute fitted?
How was it fitted? Well, you had straps over your shoulders and through your legs, between your legs, which looped through a loop that came between your legs, and they were all clipped together in a round box that was in front of your chest. And all the four straps slotted into there and were clicked in, and you turned. They were then secure in there. So if you jumped out, you left all that as it was, and you then pulled the ripcord, which was underneath your left arm, and you pulled it with your right hand. It was like a D ring, and you just gave it a big tug. And that opened the parachute, and that was it. When you landed, you didn't want the wind to blow the parachute and drag you along the ground, so you twisted this round knob on your chest, twisted it through about half a turn, gave it a thump, and then the parachute fell off. And this is what you did if ever you had to jump into the sea. You waited till you judged you were about 10 or 12 feet above the sea, gave this a slap, and the parachute fell off. Over the sea, you had a dinghy, which you sat on between the parachute and your bottom. You sat on this dinghy, and that was clipped to your Mae West, so that when the parachute fell off, the dinghy didn't. It was hooked onto you, so you presumably found yourself in the sea, inflate the Mae West, and then drag the dinghy round on its bit of string and inflate that.
So where was the parachute bag itself fitted on your body?
Well, it was behind you, between on your back thigh. When you were walking about, when you climbed into an airplane, if you had the parachute on, it was very awkward, because you've had the straps quite tight, so you could only waddle with it. It wasn't too easy climbing in and out with it. When you were in an operational aeroplane, normally it was the parachute was already in, was the crew put the parachute in the cockpit with the straps open, ready, and when you climbed in, then you strapped it on once you were in the cockpit.
At this stage as well, did you practice forced landings at all?
Oh yes, we practiced forced landings, which was quite straightforward. I mean, the instructor switches the engine off. He doesn't switch it off. He throttles it right back and says, right, your engine's failed. Find a field and land in it. And of course, this was the judgment. You had to check your height. You had to check the wind. Try and make a sensible landing in a field. You didn't, when you were practicing, you didn't actually land. You came round and you were making your approach into this field, and the instructor could judge whether you were going to make it or not. And you just opened up and went away again. Interesting thing here at Elmden, they said that there was one or two fields that were sort of earmarked for this, and the instructors knew, roughly where they were, so that you know, you had to find a field and you knew roughly which one it was, and it became common knowledge where these fields were. And one of them, the lads swore that it was adjacent to a nudist colony. Now, I can promise you that the number of times I flew round that field, I never in my life saw a naked lady. But some of the lads, who probably had a bit better imagination than I did, used to come back full of joy. Oh, we did some false landings and we saw these ladies. I don't think it, I don't know, but there was supposed to be a nudist colony.
When you're making a potential forced landing, what are the things that you have to be aware of on the ground for a location?
Well, you don't want cows in the field to start with. Obviously, you've got to try and get a field where there are not too many trees that are going to block your way in. As I say, you check which way the wind is blowing, and you try and make sure that you've got a sufficient run across the field that would allow you to land and stop, bearing in mind that if you land a tiger moth, you know, in a forced landing condition, it's not going to run very far. I mean, I don't know whether it would even run 100 yards with the engine switched off, so you didn't need an enormous field. The skill was to actually get over the hedge on the approach just at the right height.
And I take it then trees are a problem. Power lines, would they be a problem?
Oh yes, power lines. They weren't so much in those days. We probably didn't have as many power lines. But they were all marked on the map. You had a map and all these things were shown power lines. You didn't really read them on the map as you were flying, but you knew where you were going. You knew roughly where any obstructions were like that. So, you know, it wasn't something you actually picked up during the flight. You've just checked before you went, sort of thing.
And does this create a sort of sense of air awareness amongst you, that you're becoming aware of everything around you, and you're always looking on the ground to make sure that might be a useful field if I need to force land? Is that something?
Exactly.
That
this is the whole point of the training. You become second nature to you. It's like when you're driving a car, isn't it? You're driving along, you're looking for possible hazards. And you're looking for speed cameras and all that sort of thing. You just generally become aware. It's not something that you think of one by one. It's just a natural reaction. And, of course, the better pilot you are, the more you instinctively react to these things.
You mentioned, obviously, your instructor wasn't that keen on aerobatics. Mm. Did he take you through any aerobatics?
Oh, yes, he had to do a minimum amount, and we did. I mean, you know, don't get the impression I didn't do any. But he didn't relish them like some instructors did. I think the idea was, I can't truthfully remember whether it actually happened, if he felt that he wasn't giving me the proper drill, the proper instruction, he would always call another instructor in and take me out for a trip. But I managed, you know, I can't say that I relished them, but I did slow rolls and loops and...
How did you loop the aircraft?
How did you loop? Well, you had to get sufficient height, first of all. You probably needed 4,000 or 5,000 feet. You checked that there were no other aircraft that you were going to interfere with. And then you just dive the aeroplane. I think you dived it to about 130 knots, which doesn't sound much in today's world, but it sounded very fast when you're in an open cockpit plane, and you dive to that. The little trimmer that I mentioned earlier that trims the nose up, tail down thing was only like a little cheese grater thing. And the idea was you trim the aircraft a little bit nose heavy, so that when you went up over the top, you dive to 130, you then ease back on the control column with the engine going full revs, you come up not too tightly, because if you pull too tightly, you could flick the aircraft, it could lose its airworthiness, as it were. So you come up in a nice gentle pull up, and when you get to the top, when you begin to see the land coming up upside down, then you can throttle back and pull out in a nice gentle curve round until you're back on level, going straight and level again. Open up the throttle and there it is. It's a very, very simple manoeuvre, and if it's done well, you do a perfect circle so that you can actually come back into the same spot that you started. But that's not always easy to achieve.
What about the slow roll? How's that?
A slow roll was much more difficult. And I was guilty of this, I couldn't quite ever get the hang of it. You have to pull the nose up quite high. I don't know what speed, probably 120 knots or something. You pull the nose up, and again you trim the aircraft slightly nose heavy, and then you roll the aircraft by putting the control column hard to the left if you want to go left or hard. You just bang it over as hard as it can. As it rolls over, and you get to about vertical, 90 degrees, then you put a little bit of top rudder on just to keep the nose up. And when you get over onto your back, you push the stick forward a little bit just to keep the nose up. And you're judging this by the horizon. All this you're judging by the horizon. And then you keep going round, a little bit of top rudder on again, and back you come. And hopefully you won't have lost very much height doing it. If, as I used to do without being terribly clever, if you try and roll the aircraft without putting the nose up high enough to start with, then you're probably going to end up losing 200 or 300 feet just like that, and it's not a very nice sensation.
I've heard that it was difficult to do in the Tiger Moth because yes. of the amount of power that the aircraft had.
That's right. Yes, it wasn't a powerful aeroplane, about 130 horsepower, I think, or something. So it did take a bit of skill. Some lads, of course, did it much more easily than others. And again, it all comes down to the point: were you really enjoying doing aerobatics? Some lads couldn't get enough of it and they'd go off and do aerobatics all over the place. But I was always a bit more apprehensive.
Did you do a barrel roll in the Tiger Moth?
Not really in a barrel. No, you couldn't in a Tiger Moth because it didn't have enough power. But a barrel roll was something that we did later on, and that was much more easy. And when you had a powerful aeroplane, a thing I really enjoyed most, we're talking many, many years ahead now, in a Firefly, was doing what we called upward rolls, or in the slang, upward Charlies, we call them, where you just pull the nose up out of coming out of a screaming dive, and you can roll the aircraft as you're climbing, probably at least two, probably three rolls, and that was great fun because you've got plenty of speed, plenty of height, and no worries.
Did you practice at all taking off out of the wind?
Sorry?
Taking off out of the wind, so not into wind.
That's an interesting question. I don't remember that. Maybe we did. We had to learn, of course, I think I've mentioned before, taxiing the aircraft in a crosswind could be very difficult because you had no brakes. And if it was really bad, you had to have a couple of lads on the wingtips to steady you, but did we learn to yeah I suppose we did. I can remember learning to land crosswind landings. I can remember that there were two ways of doing that. You either angled off so that you were sort of like crabbing as you came in on your approach, you had your nose pointing more into the wind and you were actually crabbing down the line that you were going to land on, and then at the crucial moment, just before the aircraft was about to stall, you kicked the aircraft straight with rudder until it was pointing the way you wanted to go, and throttled off. That was it. Or you could do it another way, and that was bank the aircraft slightly so that you were holding the aircraft in a bank or a side slip situation, really, holding the nose into wind again, and then just as you got to this point of stall, just level things off, and there it is. But it was not easy in a Tiger Moth because it was so light and sensitive, and the wind was not necessarily nice and calm and steady. It could gust, and when it gusted, well, of course, the aeroplane gusted with it.
Did you do any instruments flying at all with the Tiger Moth?
Yes, we did. We had this hood that pulled over the back cockpit. It was like the hood of a pram, is the only way I can describe it. And you sat in the rear cockpit. You could do it yourself. You pulled the hood right over, and there was a catch or something that made sure it stayed secure. And then you couldn't see out, and you just had to fly according to the instruments, which again in a Tiger Moth was not very easy because you only had very basic instruments. I mean, you had an altimeter which told you whether you were going up or down, but it wasn't terribly sensitive. The airspeed indicator, if it was increasing, the speed was increasing, you suspected that you were diving, so you watched that. The compass was just an ordinary magnetic compass. You didn't have a gyro compass in a Tiger Moth. So the compass was tended to swing about a bit. So the way I used to try and keep the aircraft straight was assuming, and you had to be lucky, of course, assuming that the sun was shining when you were doing this, that the light coming through the hood, where the sun was coming, I'd note that and think, well, that's where the sun is, and if I keep it there, that I must be going in a straight line. If the light from the sun suddenly changed, I knew I'd swerved off course, which sounds a bit daft, but I found it worked. I didn't tell anybody else.
Is it the case then that it's very easy to become your body to be telling you that you're doing something that the aircraft isn't doing?
Yes, very much so. And this is why you learn flying on instruments. The essential is that you must always rely on the instruments, because I mean, in the real world, if you were flying in a bad cloud or something like that, and you just couldn't see anything, and you rely on the seat of your pants, as we say, you could feel that you were doing something completely different. And this, I'm sure, well, I think it's been proved that some of the accidents that happened were people who did not rely on their instruments. And there were one or two cases when we got onto Harvard's, I'm probably jumping ahead a bit now, you had gyro instruments that you could cage, and you uncaged them to set them in the, you know, to correspond with the direction you were going, and the same with the attitude indicator. You know, whether you were banking, climbing. Now, if you got those caged, of course they were caged. No, they didn't tell you anything. And there were certainly one I heard of, and probably more than one, chaps taking off at night, and they had failed to unlock their instruments, and so they took off thinking they were flying straight and normally, and they were going into some dreadful situation and crashed. So it was all a question of drill.
So initially then, is it a difficult thing to just kind of grasp that the plane will be doing something different from what your body's saying it's doing?
Yes, it is difficult. But if again, just backtrack a little bit, before you start flying instruments under the hood in an aeroplane, we had a thing called a link trainer, which was like a little dummy aeroplane fixed up in a hangar somewhere, which never moved, it just spun round on its own axis. and it was all switched on, and you could climb in there, and you were plugged into an instructor who told you what to do, and you just did what he told you, purely on instruments. And it was a very clever thing, because he could build into that bumpy conditions. He could build into all sorts of things, so that you got the impression, not from the seat of your pants, but from the instruments, that you were actually flying in bumpy weather and that sort of thing. Whatever you did in the cockpit was reproduced on a table with a thing called a crab, which tracked across like a map on this table. And when you got out of the link train, the instructor would show you exactly what you had been doing, at least as far as the track was concerned. And it was something we none of us liked, because it was a bit boring, I suppose. And it was something that we had to do sometimes if the weather was too bad to fly, or we'll go off and do some link trainer. And in fact, in my logbook, I think we even had to record the number of times we did it. But it was a very useful thing to have, bearing in mind you could never crash it.
Did you do any night flight at Elmden at all?
We did. We didn't do it at Elmden. There was a place called Hockley Heath, I've often wondered what it was. Just basically a field, a big field alongside a road. I suppose I ought to get a map out sometime and try and find it. But it was Hockley Heath, and what you did there, I think they had two or three tents set up. You didn't stay there overnight. You flew two or three aeroplanes over to Hockley Heath in the daytime, and then the instructors came over. They probably flew the aircraft over anyway. And then you just spent the early part of the night. I don't think we went on too late in the night. And we flew from this field. And all they did was they set out what they called gooseneck flares, which went back to way before the war. They were just like, I think, paraffin or kerosene jars, really, with flaming tops on them. And the ground crew set these out like a runway, depending on the strength of the wind and the line of the wind, and that was where we flew, and it was quite good fun. Well, it was when we were there, because it was summertime.
And when you flew, did you just fly an ordinary circuit and
yes, you didn't down? You didn't do too much, bearing in mind that in 1943 England was blacked out, so there wasn't a lot to go on. They had various aerodromes had flashing lights, rather like lighthouses, and these were called pundits. And each aerodrome had a Morse code identity, which could change to fool any enemy that might be flying around. So it was possible to locate where you were from these pundits if you knew the code. But just flying round Hockley Heath, I don't think we ever really went away from the circuit. We just kept flying round the circuit.
And in doing that, are you keeping a visual on the gooseneck flares on the runway?
Yes, yes. I mean, that was as a novice, that's the first thing to do, is make sure you don't get lost. So it was quite straightforward.